794 Sorgel, June 7, 2008. Consideration of lecture 1.3b through 1.4. Self-evaluation criteria. All right, vendor support. So what kind of support are available? They phone. Some of them may still have the automated fax. You send them some, or you somehow request a fax and a certain thing. Email is quite frequent now. Website, some bulletin board or a knowledge base. Well, actually, knowledge base is usually on the website, but they may have some sort of user group. And what we actually be added there is the chat. Some do offer chat support. I guess this website, you could also put Wiki. Some of them do that. Now, one of the evaluation criteria is cost, response time, and did the problem actually get fixed? Sometimes I don't know what it is. I meant to put another one here. I don't know why I did. I mean, taking over your computer. That's... Well, they can have an arrangement, if you allow them, whereby the tech support person can take over your machine.
They can do it online.
They can do it online, so they can fix whatever the problem is, or they can show you, or they can exactly analyze what the problem is, because often it's sort of hard to describe what the problem is. And so they can fix it. Now, it says here vendor support, but the same comment that applies to documentation and help applies here as well. This could be through a party. Or, if it's a very large organization, they could create an internal help desk, which could sort of give help customized to the organization, and in that case, they wouldn't care what the company does. Okay, so this criterion, you have to see how you apply it. I mean, OIT here, the Office of Information Technology, at least for faculty, they give some tech support for some programs. They don't support them all. I know I use Eudora for email, they don't support Eudora. If it's Eudora, I'm on mail. But other questions, I might answer. And many universities do that. Then there's error handling. This is more important, clearly, to programming than and to things where you write formulas and stuff. But actually, even in a Word cell, you could write a formula that's wrong that gives an error message. Whether you would want to, you could, by some stretch, put spell check and grammar check in here, but that's more like a feature than an error checking. I mean, it's really errors that the user makes in some way. And for error messages, the same sort of context sensitivity levels apply that you already had done for help. Okay, so I don't think I want to get into much more detail in the G1 I'm going to skip because we have a separate extensive lecture on these same issues in the action piece. So we're going to talk about it then. But history of user action. we need to talk about.
I have a question about that.
About which? Okay.
Because communities exist that would help, you know, like you have Photoshop communities online that would
help. Right.
Would you take that into account even though they're free and they're just created by...
Absolutely. That would be, that's a third party.
Even though it's not paid for.
Yes, actually, I meant to say that I'm going to write it down for my next. Whether you pay, if it's free, it's all the better.
So this is under F3, under.
Under F3, yeah. I mean, so vendor support is really too narrow. It's available support, and clearly you would look to the vendor. But that's not the only. And again, reviews will look primarily at the vendor. But if there's a very active community where you type in a question and half an hour later you get an answer from somebody, who cares about vendor support? Okay. So, as long as you can get... Can you get help? When F1, the implementation online help failed, I mean, the next level is get help in some way from some person usually. I mean, if there's a knowledge base in online help, often a search in that might answer your question, but sometimes not, because it's hard to specify the problem to search right in those cases. Okay, and a person has a higher capacity of ability to understand what you're talking about than a system does. But wherever that person sits, if there's somebody available to give an answer somehow, then that will they'll do it. Any other questions on F before we move on? Okay. So history of user actions, again, a lot of that is for brokers, but it's also other things. I mean, the first one, ability to edit or recall input line. When you do a search, it's nice to be able, I mean, if you do the next search, find in a program. It's nice to have that string still be there. If you want to search for it again, it's even nicer if you can have a drop-down box where you can go back in history and find another. An earlier string you search for, because you might want to search for it again. So this would be one example of history of user actions even just in any program that you use a find, which would be a browser or a word processor or a word processing or a spreadsheet. So in the other hand, in the programs where you have to enter sort of command lines of some nature, it's nice to be able to edit those. And I don't know whether any of you use Unix. Or the olden days of DOS, it's really not that much different. You know. So DOS is much maligned in Unix. used, but if you're using a command line, there's still things you use in a command line mode. And if you type in a long command line, you press enter and it says it was an error. It's very annoying if you cannot get it back and fix the error. But actually, I mean, they're all similar things in websites. In most websites where you have to enter data, if there is an error, the old data is still there. But I have seen some where you have something is wrong and your whole input goes away for a whole template of inputs and you have to start all over again. So the criteria still applies to some pieces outside of programming, even that's where they are mostly. Macro definitions that could be considered as a history of user actions. I mean, actually, the way you do macros in Brut, you record them. Unless you're really proficient and you go into the macro programming language. In which case, even in Brut, you have to debug. Because I mean, behind the macro facility in Word and in some other, in Word Perfect too, in some other languages, there's a whole programming language of things to do in text processing. So if you can edit that, that's nice.
Macros are another one that it's something I've heard of, and I think I've had to use them before, but don't really understand what they are as a, other than deal with this macro right now, kind of.
Okay, so a macro is a package of steps that you've defined in some way and that can be executed by either pressing a button, I mean clicking on a button, or pressing a shortcut key.
Okay.
Or possibly pressing a generic key or a generic button to execute a macro and then type in the name. So, in a way, a macro is a computer program. But it's more ad hoc in a way. So, if you have a sequence, the same sequence of clicks you do often in Word, you can turn on capture macro. It will capture that series of clicks. And you can then, when you stop, you say, you put it at the end, and you give it a name, and you can assign it a key. And next time you have to do the same sequence of clicks, you just invoke the macro. And the Word also has a macro language where you specify the sequence of steps as if you write a macro. I mean, a JavaScript. It's not that much difference. It's not the same environment. It's not using the same functionality, but it's the same thing as a macro.
That makes a lot of sense.
Okay.
The access database, that's one of the main things that when something gets changed and it's not agreeing with access today, it's something wrong with something with the macros.
I see. Okay.
The OS doesn't like it. Something and...
Right. So to give you another example, in I defined the database a long time ago, I mean 20 years ago, but I still use it because it's a lot of definition. So I've before, and there's often, this is to input products and items in the database to allocate it as gifts to children, and we have 20 of one item, one type of thing. And so it needs 20 different records in the database, because each will be linked up with some child at some point. And so clearly you end in the same information, and there is a way to copy from one record to the next, and so it may take 4 keystrokes to do it. But I just find a macro that packages those 4 keystrokes. So all the actual user does is say alt some function key, and that will create a new record for the same thing but with a new number. And there are a lot of other, there's a number of other such macros which has 2 advantages. One, the user couldn't memorize a sequence of 4 or 5 things you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
And 2, it's quicker. And even if you do, So it's easier. And easier to use. And you can see how the ability to define macros can be used to adapt a program to make the ease of use much better. That's the and so when you judge a program in ease of use, you always have to judge it against what it could be once customized, rather than coming out of the box. And that's what's here. In a macro programming language, you can even program a macro that's a loop that's executed repeatedly to do a certain change. A global change, of course, does that automatically. But there are other changes you want to make that you cannot easily do with a global change, and you just want to go and find every word and do something at that point. But for that, you have to sort of program. I think the only program I know of where I can do a macro with a loop just on the keyboard is WorkPerfect 5.1. So sometimes you have to do this. I save the document in WorkPerfect 5.1 format, and I define the macro, and I do it, and then. So if I do Perl, I probably could do the same thing, maybe just as quickly, maybe not quite as quickly. But it's nice. So the more you can do with macro stuff from the keyboard without getting the programming, the easier it is. Another area of history of user actions is to have a history of things you copied, pieces of text you copied. Word has such a history if you know how to use it. You can use a utility that does it for any kind of program. Which, by the way, besides it to another a general remark on when you do this evaluation. Assume this being able to remember previous deletions and copy them back in, and not just the last, is important to you. And you evaluate two work processing programs, and one does it and the other doesn't. But the one that doesn't is better in many other ways. Well, there's a generic utility, and you can teach the users how to use it. And it'll be just as easy to do it there than to do it in the program itself. And so this is a shortcoming of one program that can be fixed by getting a cheap other program. And when you evaluate, you have to keep that in mind as well. Because ultimately what counts is what application environment where the users can do what they need to do can you put on the user's desktop. And so in that case, it just means you get the work processing program and a little utility. And that does it, so it's fine. So you have to actually, the design space is not just get one piece of software. The design space is get some combination of software that will do the piece, and that's the evaluation object, if you will. So it says the ability to annotate history items, so you can make some annotations. The last one, ability to save the workspace. That is very convenient. So say you have 5 documents open in Word and you need to close down for the day, now you need to close them all. You need to close Word. And when you start open next morning, you still want to, you have to just open 5 documents again. And you really would like to be in each of them where you were yesterday, which you have to then go to. Saving the workspace just you close the program, when you open it again, you are exactly where you left off. Very helpful. Now, in Windows XP, this applies to the operating system, you can do something called Hibernate, where it will store the entire content of memory on disk. And then it will shut off. I think most computers will shut off. Some of them use still some powerful reason, I don't understand. On my ThinkPad, it just turns off completely. And so, for example, I can go on airplanes. Turn off. And then when I'm on the airplane, I turn it off again. And everything is exactly where I was before. I didn't close any programs. I didn't do anything. And so this is very useful. If you do it too often, I think Windows is a poor program in terms of leaving all kinds of trash lying around in memory. And so it's a good idea from time to time to just close all programs and restart your computer completely. But if you do that once a week, you're fine. Otherwise, I use Hibernate a lot. And so this would be safe workspace. In this case, globally, for the entire... I would still like to save the workspace for individual programs. And I don't know whether the world does that or not. I don't use it enough to know. The history of user actions, defaults. Is this here a second time? I think I already mentioned this somewhere else. Defaults are very important for ease of use. So use defaults where appropriate, and the most important thing, sensible defaults. And not only Vue, but other programs violate that rule. It's just poor. No. If you can set your own, then, and if you can set them easily, at least that's something useful. But I'll give you one example where Vue purchases a poor default. When you save a document, it is very helpful to save the previously saved copy as a backup. So that when you see, wait a minute, I made this big mistake and I used this word instead of that word, but then you can back to the version before that save easily. So if you save it again, then you're out of luck. And unless, I mean, there may be a program where you can go several versions back. I don't know of any real processing problem that does. But anyway, defaults, by default, WorkPerfect doesn't do that. You have to go in and set it. Or, now, by default, it does save every 10 minutes, I think. That is the copy it uses to recover from a crash. So when your computer system crashes or WorkPerfect itself crashes and cannot recover, then the most rule you can use is 10 minutes, depending on when it last did it. So I set default to 5, and actually I think 5 minutes is a better default. Depending on how large the documents are you work on and how fast your computer is. If you have 7 large documents open simultaneously and you switch from one to the other working on them, then saving them every 5 minutes can actually get in the way sometimes. But that's a rare, very rare occasion. And the user who does that is savvy enough to change the default. So anyway, that's important. So G4 actually talks more about customization and macro function and key definition. So in G2, the macro is just figured in the sense that one way of defining macros is capturing certain steps you do. And by the way, most programs let you capture those steps only when you set capture for macro. it doesn't capture them otherwise. But it would be really nice to say, go back in your user history and highlight the sequence of keystrokes you did and say, package those in a macro. You can't do that in any program I know. But there's generally customization. So can you configure things like the, how often a behind-the-scenes backup is made for cache recovery? There are many defaults. I think most word processing programs by default capitalize a character typed after a period. Most highlight the whole word when you highlight a piece of it. Both of those I don't like. And so I would like to go in and change them. Some have as a default the curly quotes, which can get you in a lot of trouble in if you save into a text file where the quotes matter, and they even in the text file they come as different character codes and from what the number quote is. So all of those things should be easily customizable by the user. And some of those customizations in WordPerfect are hard to find. Where do you actually make a change? On the other hand, where to save files is easy. Windows has its My Documents. No, not My Documents. What is it called? What is that folder called?
My documents,
and then it has all kinds of subdirectories, application data, and
yeah.
And so if the template that saves all my configuration and for WordPerfect is in some directory 7 levels down. So I define myself a directory DS data. And all application templates, all those kinds of templates are in there. And I can go into the programs and say, the data are kept here. The email program usually has an attached folder, several levels down. I define a top level folder attached. But I can only do that if it's customizable, that I configure where the attached folder should be. So to make this easy to use, configuration is important. And again, for less knowledgeable users, it pays to have, in a large organization anyway, to have a computer consultant who helps. In a small organization, it pays to have somebody on call. And you pay him $100 an hour, and he comes and makes you the macros you need, and it saves you hours of time. It's perfect. So, how do you define macros? There's an interesting difference. Keystroke macros will capture every keystroke and then do what it says. They are also a stupid kind of macros, result macros. Say, if you would be a good example. If you want to have a macro to open the directory and find, well, actually, the sub macro maybe, and find a specific file, you could, the keystrokes you would do, generally, you would say control over open. And then I think in most directories you have to highlight at least one file. And then you can type a level. And it will scroll down to that level of better arrangement. And then you can use the down arrow key till you come to the actual file you want to select. And then you can close the capture. For a keystroke macro, if you invoke the macro, it was the same keystrokes. And what happened in the meantime, you have changed the directory. It will find a different file. So in that case, actually, the solid macro would be better. A macro that finds the same file that you found then, no matter what the keystrokes are. And so you can do either one. By the way, the process I just described is based on some stability in how these directory surfaces are done. Because if it was really working well, it would search as you type in characters. So if you want to search for Victor, V-I-C-T-O-R, would find Victor. Whereas the V will find you the first one starting with V. Then if you type an I, it would go to the one to start with I. And who came up with that stupid idea, I don't know. But it's now the rule in all kinds of sources of drop-down lists. And if you have a drop-down list of states,
some of them will work if you type quickly, if you type fluently, and you type like Maryland, and they are.
It will actually come. Okay.
It will do that. But if you type M and then you think about it for a second, and type A, it goes back up to Alabama.
Yes. I don't do that.
No. That's what it does. I mean, all the vector systems I know now, they're working with. If it worked the other way, then you could make a keystroke macro that finds a specific file. But not there. All right. Anyway, so then there's also how do you assign a shortcut here or button as a macro? A shortcut key, you should be able to just type it in. Say, when it asks you for a name for the macro, you just type Alt-P. And the sign is that key. Word lets you do that. Word Perfect does not. I mean, the old Word Perfect lets you do that. The new Word Perfect doesn't. So you have to give this thing a name, and then you have to go to another procedure to assign the macros who are named to a shortcut key or to a button. So it's cumbersome. Can you edit the macro once it's defined?
Yeah, you should be able to.
You can only do that if there's a macro programming language, which you can find. So maybe you could define everything in the macro programming language if you know the language. But it may be easier to define the capturing keystrokes and then edit it. There are other things that is here, like ability to define function keys, which is essentially being able to assign a function key to a macro. And can you do Shift-Control F1 as a key different from Shift-F1 and Control-F1 and all those? These are all... The last two lines here about special characters, they are relevant only for... like programming languages, where characters have special significance. Like a percent sign means something. Can you get out of it? Can you somehow say, but this time it really means a percent sign? Actually, it's in HTML pages that appears. Because some things mean something special. And if you want the actual character, it's a backslash with the character. Now, complete customization is sort of what is called create join key systems. But again, that is more relevant to, say, a database management system. Can you define an accounting system where the people don't even need to know that it was done in Oracle? And they deliver the Oracle runtime version with it, and so it just works as if it was programmed in something else. I think that's the multi-user capability. That's very short. I mean, can you have multiple users? For database management system, that's imperative. Most well, unless it's something that just runs in your own machine and you're the only one using it. So I think actually access doesn't have a multi-user capability, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. It's one user at a time.
Yeah, and you try to have two people on it at once. Things don't go well.
But for real DBMS work, you need to be able to have two. For word processing, we talked about collaborative software before, that that three people see the same document on the screen. I don't know whether they can do that using Word. I suspect they have to have their own editing environment for that particular piece. But it would be nice if Word would fit into such environment. Okay. Security. I will do very briefly, I think. So, I mean, you can just boil it down to the question, does it support any kind of security? In a word processor, it would mean, can you password protect a document? Can you password protect even opening the thing, the beginners? Can you encrypt the document? So that when you send it to somebody else, actually password protection without encryption doesn't do much good. Because if you send it, somebody else could go in the file. It has to be encrypted. DBMS needs a lot more. And the I2 has sort of a grid for the security definition, how you can define it. So there's a level of access to the system, or the whole database, or actually one level is missing here, a table. So you could provide access to certain tables only to certain people, but you could even go to a data field, so a particular field has sensitive information can only be accessed by these people, or it could be even more specific by records. And think about it, the university has a database of grades, and you can access your grades, but not somebody else. So it cannot be just be done on tables and fields. It has to be done on content. When I go into the graduate student system, I can look at records of my advisees, but not at records of other students. And I suspect, actually I don't know whether the GLIS student service office can look at student records of any other department. They used to be able to, I'm not sure that they still can. That would be useful, for example, if somebody, some student from another department wants to enroll in a course of mine. And I, in that case, would want to know what other courses they have taken before in order to see whether that's the background. In that case, I can ask them. That's just, I do it. It would be more convenient just to be able to ask them. But there still is usefulness and privacy concerns. But can you do these kind of security definitions? And if you were to do a DBMS for a university student system, you would have to make sure that it has a security definition at that time. There's also in I3 security can be defined by group. They have this in the federal government. They have classified confidential and classified, and there are several levels of classification, right? Secret and top secret. And in order to be eligible to access top secret documents, you have to have a top secret clearance. And if every top secret cleared person could look at every top secret document, that would be security definition just by user group. It's actually not works that way, because even the top secret, it's a necessary condition to have a top secret clearance to access any top secret document, but not sufficient. You also have to have a need to know. So clear is the most flexible, but also in some way the most requiring the most effort. Here the definition is to do it just on individual users, username and password. It's much easier to define things by groups. So for example, if you belong to the faculty, you can access the university student directory. I think if you're a student, you can too. So if you're a member of the university community, you can. If not, if you come from the outside, you cannot. So that security definition is done by two groups. And you could define more groups. I mean, there could be alpha information that's accessible to all faculty. Then there would be a group-based security definition, or sometimes they also call it role-based, as opposed to individual. But as you saw, in some cases, it has to be individual. Like this business, I can only access the full records of my advisees. No, well, I guess you could say, it's to my name. Okay. All right, the next one is a bit more. Let me just conclude this. Security is extremely important in some environments. So, for the software evaluation that you do, you have to first of all see, is security important and how? And it may be fairly simple. But if it's not, and particularly, I mean, if it's more complex and in real life, then you have to learn a lot more about security than I just told you. Even I just told you enough to sensitize you to the problem. If it's really an issue, then I would read a book on security, or maybe start with a Wikipedia article if it's any good, or get some outside consulting advice on what you best do with security. So input output and working with other programs is here lumped together because a big piece of working with other programs may be simply able to output data in a certain file format. So if you want to get data from Excel into Oracle, there's a common delimited text file format that Excel can produce, and if it's structured right, Oracle can read to populate tables. So then in that case the compatibility becomes simply an input-output question, and there are often sort of pipelines of that nature, but first just plain input-output. So that's nothing to do with working with other programs. It's just, what can I do with it? Can I input out what input-output devices are supported? So actually, in a way, this harks, I just realized, this harks back to the, what was it?
D1,
the hospital. But it says a little more to it. So can I specify that keystrokes that normally would come from the keyboard are now read from a file? so that, that I can give to the file and it will just do 100 keystrokes in a row, the same way as if I type them in. Some programs do this, some don't. And what input devices are the poorest? Keyboard, disk, modem. Can I read something just like on the modem? Mouse, scanner. A lot of that is now handled by the operating system, so that doesn't really matter too much for the program. Then the other piece, where to output? Screen? Printer? A disk, can I, in a word processing program, could I specify that I want the output that would normally go to the printer go on a disk? So say it's a post, people know about PostScript. So PostScript is a format for printing, okay, which is done by Adobe. And just to tell you, HP has its own format, PCL. They do support PostScript. And actually, I mean, just as an aside, when you have to do a printer definition for an HP printer, you are better off to define it as PostScript, because then any other PostScript capable printer will print your document the same way. And if you do documents like I do, very carefully formatting and taking out a word here and there to fit this on a page and make the paper at the right time, and you use it on the PostScript, and then you run it on the PCL, there may just be enough difference that one line runs out, and the whole formatting is bad. So it's good to have a standard output. I think it just happened to me. I looked at this document and I said, what is this? I had this nicely formatted. And so I had defined my printer, I take with me when I travel often. It's an HP inkjet printer. And WordPerfect's default, which I now changed from a configuration, is to, on opening, format a document for the default printer. So it formatted it for the little inkjet, which is a different printing format. And some of the things just were not quite the same. Now, if you don't, if you're not that careful about it, it doesn't matter. But if you are really particular and you want it this way, then it matters. So it's useful to have the PostScript printer. Now, you may not have a printer right handy, but you may want to print it anyway so you can send the print file to somebody who does not have your word processing program. And they could just send the printer file to their printer. It's just like copy to the printer. And then it will print out. So, if the printer is not PostScript capable and send them a PostScript file, often it will print out this gibberish. Many codes that specify formatting, then some text, and then codes formatting and some text. And, that's what the PostScript file looks like. And that's the character stream that goes to the PostScript printer and prints. That's a normal operation. But if you can direct this to a file, then you can print it from any machine that has a PostScript printer attached to it, even if they don't have your program. So maybe nice to know, can it do that? So input-output. The more important... We did talk before under D1, what output devices are supported. That's really... So can you do a plotter? That doesn't... Here it assumes that it supports these devices, but you can, at the time you output something, you can say where it's supposed to go. That's the ability in K1. K2, this is input and output formats. So how many different word processor formats can WordPerfect import? How many different formats of data can Excel import? If I want to get data out of Access into Excel, is there a way to do it through files? And so this is import format, and I just delimited text is sort of a universal kind of format, a common delimited text. So it could be another character. That then would be the question. So if I have a comma delimited text file, could I define a different character for the separation of elements in the input? So instead of a comma, could I use a pipe? Everybody knows a pipe, a vertical line. It's called a pipe, I don't know why. So if it's delimited text, can you specify what the delimiter is? Because if you think about it, the comma is really sort of stupid. Because it often occurs in text. And so in a comma delimited file, the data items themselves need to be enclosed in quotes. In order to avoid the possibility that there's a comma within the text. Or could it be some, looking at other programs and their output formats, how easily could they be imported into the program you talk about? In data export, it's the same. And so essentially what it means is here, with what other programs can you exchange data? And the exchange can always happen if the producing program A has some export format that is also an import format of the target program B. But on a higher level, this means can a library program export malloc format? The novel could easily read the malloc format. Okay. There's another interchange. There is a standard that's known by the name Z39.50. And it is a standard essentially in which to define fields in a bibliographic record. There's a common definition. And also to define fields that are formal for queries. So if you have a library catalog that supports, that can read queries in the format specified in that standard, and that can export bibliographic records in that format. If you know how to send Z39.50 queries, and if you know how to interpret Z39.50 bibliographic records, then you can search that catalog. Regardless of what the internal structure of that catalog is. And there are programs, what I know is Bookware, and maybe others. Actually, the Library of Congress has a website that's based on Z39.50. If you buy Bookware now and you put it in your computer, it will come with a database of over 1,000 library catalogs. And it has an interface that you input a query. It has an interface where you can browse the results. And so you can do search for books, and you can search 1,000 catalogs at the same time. That's interoperability of programs by input output. Now, how can you integrate with directly? Can you use other components? Give you one example of this. I got this file manager that sort of better than what comes with Windows XP, and it has a viewer pane, so where you can see directory and you look and you see this. And I couldn't see my preview, my WordPerfect documents or many others. And so I looked and can do it. I asked them what worked. Said, well, we can work with any program that can display. And they told me one in particular works well. It's called QuickView. And it's a Zen bot. And it reads like 300 different things or more. All kinds of word browsers, all kinds of image formats, it reads a lot. And my file manager uses that as like a plugin. So when it's on the system, it uses it. And so now I can see whatever I want to see in my pane. It's another example of get the functionality on the desktop. Two programs this time. But there may be a file manager that sees, that can read directly, natively, more formats, more file formats than mine can. But it certainly won't read as many as this QuickView, which specializes on that function. And the other file manager, from what I read in reviews, would not have all the functionality of dealing with directories and other things that I want to do that mine does. So having those two programs, I have the best of breed for either function. And since they work together, it works fine. So this would be a case 3 indicating other components. And particularly on browsers, you know, plugins are big. And the increased functionality, and so can a browser take all the things, plugins that you want in order to do things. K4 is somewhat less important, or K5. Some programs allow you to do operating systems things from within the program itself. K6, actually, that should be closer with K3 now that I look at this, because it's very similar. For WordPerfect and for Word, you can buy a collection of macros that do all kinds of things and install it in the macro directory, and then you can use them. So there probably is a collection of macros for functions often used in preparing legal documents. And then you could buy that and, without a lot of work, customize WordPerfect for that purpose. Okay. And so if there's a toss-up between two word processes and one has that kind of tool available and the other doesn't, that may make a difference in which one you get. For operating systems, I mean, that's well known. If you decide between Linux and Windows, well, what's available in software that runs under each? That's a big selling point. Which is a high entry barrier into the operating system market. Because if you do something entirely new, obviously, there's no software. That's thank you. So this is, again, the relation to other software. Okay. Any questions about any of the criteria? Now again, as I said, some of these criteria may be important to your type of software, and some of it might not.
It's something that that kept occurring to me, and I'm wondering when you're doing evaluations. I mean, if it's something that's going to sit on your desk and you're going to use all the time, and you're going to become the owner of the software and you're going to use it all the time, then all the customization and macros and making it suit your purposes perfectly is very important. Whereas if it's something that you're going to load in the library and have people walk in and use for an hour and leave, it's much more important that it be easy for them to figure out how to use it. You know, that learning curve, very little teeny bit at the beginning of learning.
Right.
So when we evaluate things, should we be weighting our evaluation heavily towards what it is we want to do with it?
Yes.
Not a general
yes.
use thing.
Yes, yes.
Because then we won't even let the kids customize stuff in the lab, you know. Like, you're not allowed to mess with the software, just use it.
However, your kids have certain requirements that are mostly common to that group.
And then you want to be able to go in as the system administrator and customize
yes.
all of it
yes.
to suit your purposes.
Yes.
Because I understand that's another distinction.
And that's very important that you be able to do that.
Yeah. But if you're looking at like a Winnebago-like thing, being able to customize it for your environment is very important. But like for the thing that I'm looking at, it's much less so because you know, you just want people to be able to use it with very little instruction.
Right, but again, being usable with very little instruction often means customization. If certain functions are not well defined in that software and take more work and you could define it more easily through customization, it would make it easier to use. Now, you might also think, well, in some application to support homework, it doesn't matter how it relates to other programs. Well, if they support note-taking,
mm-hmm.
if the note-taking could be done in Word,
you've got to be able to import and export things.
Or if it could be done natively in Word,
mm-hmm.
or in an application that emulates Word, it would be much better than if it didn't. And of course, I mean, if it doesn't use natively Word, then you should be able to export to Word.
Mm-hmm.
So even there, it makes a difference. If it's on a website, actually, if it's on a website, there are other considerations like if the user stuff kept there or can they download their stuff on a stick.
How is their information stored and how much
yep.
how much can they personalize them?
And can they extract it and take it with them?
But what you're saying is your evaluation is from your point of view, from
yes.
what you intend to do with it.
Yes, yes, yes. Because that's how it has to be in real life.
So it's not really a software evaluation, it's kind of a needs-based evaluation?
Yeah.
From it's software evaluation? Well, yeah, it's needs-based. Yes. You would definitely look at the software as it could be enriched by plugins. So in that sense that it's applied to a specific need is different from a generic software review. In the sense that you should look at capabilities as enhanced by other pieces, that is important for a general software review, just as well as it is for your specific one. The same is the documentation and the help. It's the same thing. I mean, the generic software review should look at documentation wherever it's available.
Right.
It should look at help, I mean, as a personalized help, as a support, wherever it's available. Wherever it's available publicly, whereas if you do it for a given organization, if you know you have a help desk, and you know your own health assistance support group, that would be specific to an organization and not to generic software. I mean, generic software review may say, if you have your own internal health test to deal with it, go for it. If you don't, look someplace else. So to that extent, it may be reflected generically, but that still wouldn't tell. I mean, when you then evaluate it for the specific organization, you would still have to take that advice and say, well, do we have a help desk? Are they capable of doing this?
We're doing a specific evaluation. We're going to use general reviews.
Yes. Yes.
Gain information.
Yes. 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 All right, let me just see how we do this. I think what I'm going to do go a little longer than the next break and at least get a good start on 1.5. So now we're getting into procedures. And Nielsen will tell you more on some aspects of this, not all. But that's what you sort of need to consider when you do your evaluation plan. First, and very important, was already alluded to, there's a difference between testing and evaluation. Testing, in a sense, is more task independent. I mean, if you do a really thorough test, you will test all the features. You will test for bugs, and you will, there are ways to do that, and we'll look at that. So in the evaluation, you will then apply this to your needs. That's what we just talked about. The evaluation will weigh different features differently, depending on the use of the software. So consumers report thus testing, and it gives you the results of their testing. They also give you advice on your evaluation when they sort of take you through what you should think about as you select the product for your purpose. But then to actually arrive at a score or a preference for your own purposes, you have to do that by applying the test results specifically to your situation. That's evaluation. And that's a very important distinction that people often overlook. I'm sure you have all heard in some course or other about information retrieval testing. And people rank information retrieval systems based on test results, but in order to rank them, they have to assign weights to performance measures, which usually, for better or for worse, and we're going to in discussion of that part, are recall and precision. And so when they rank those systems, they have to use a given weighting for recall and precision. Whereas in reality, for some question that's posed, the focus is on recall. And if I can good recall with good precision, which sometimes you can, so much the better. But if you cannot, and sometimes to increase the recall, you have to take a loss in precision. Then for that question, you would do a search that emphasizes recall, and if need be, takes a loss in precision. Whereas for some other question, it would be the other way around. Okay. So what really counts in looking at a retrieval system is whether it allows that flexibility. Whether the user has control of the search to the extent that they can emphasize one or the other. Again, as I said, if need be, there's this myth that good recall always means bad precision. That's a myth. That's just people who don't know what they're talking about. But where there is a trade-off, it would be nice to be able to steer that trade-off as I use them. And that's a good characteristic of a retrieval system. And that's not taken into account in a retrieval system testing and then ranking systems. And the ranking part of the evaluation, so it really goes beyond the testing. Right, so that distinction is important. Okay, the context. We just talked about one, which is sort of a general review to be read by the general public or anybody interested in the software, and the needs-focused review. There's another distinction that falls under this heading. I'm going to make myself a note that the general or the needs space should be in here, the heading. But the other is the distinction that those of you in the education media program certainly have heard about, because it comes out of education, between what is called formative evaluation and summative evaluation. The name always implies it. The purpose of formative evaluation is to improve the product. Okay. So that's evaluation that's happening as the program is being developed. And since programs are always being developed, it could happen all the time. And so, I mean, software companies collect error reports and suggestions for improvement in order to get a better second edition, second version. Version 2 is better than version 1. But a lot of testing should happen even before the first version comes out. That's formative evaluation by and for the producer. And then there is testing and evaluation from a consumer perspective. And the consumer can't really do anything about the product. The computer just has to decide between A and B and C. And that's what's called summative evaluation. And the purpose is to aid in consumer decision which product to use. Originally, this distinction was, I think, formulated in testing curriculum. How they work. And so the formative evaluation is to develop a good curriculum. The summative evaluation, if you have two, which one should you choose? Okay. Then I enumerated here a number of perspectives of testing. Or you could also say aspects to be tested. Okay. Okay, so the first thing is, what does the program do? Feature analysis. How correct does it do it? That's program correctness. And by the way, all of these can be done either in formative evaluation or in summative evaluation. Okay, and program correctness for formative evaluation is there to discover the bugs before the program hits the market. That's often, I mean, there's a, they do this in-house first, but then they're, most software goes through a process they call beta testing. Alpha testing is what they're doing in-house. And then beta testing, they're releasing it to a beta testing community, and people use it in real environments. And say they find some, it doesn't work if I also have this software running. How can you figure all of that out in the lab? Behold, and there are many of the people, things people do that the program never thought about they would do. And these things come out in beta testing. Okay. Program performance, how efficiently does it run? And we'll talk about procedures in a minute. The beta testing was just sort of a look ahead. How easy is it to use? And then the final, which is the most difficult, but in some ways the most important. What difference does using that program make? So if this is a program that's supposed to help students to learn, what do they actually learn? If this is a program to produce a production of documents, now that we have this program, do people indeed take less time? If this is a program to support the decision on mortgage applications, there are two questions we'll ask. Are mortgage applications done taking less time from the, what is it called, these people, like Palmer, in the bank? They have a name for the people who decide on mortgages. Does it speed loan officer? Does it speed up the work of the loan officer? Does it improve the quality of the decisions? Do we have fewer foreclosures now that we have this program so that we can make better decisions? Okay. So these are different aspects you need to consider in testing and evaluation. Any questions on that piece?
I guess I'm a little bit concerned about what stuff we're doing, to what degree we can, I guess we'd have to get it from evaluations, what impact the program has. Because I'm not going to be able to run it in my library for a year and then write up a report on it. So that's...
Do we talk about impact in the end? Yes, I do. It's not very long. There's not a very long list, but we can discuss it then. But that is for some programs easier than for us. So for feature analysis, well, we just checked the feature list with the program test. Sometimes that may not be specific enough, and then what do? It may say it deals with tables. Can you easily copy one table column from one place to the other? The manual may tell you how to do it. It would be one way. And if not, you would then have to dial up. So features that you have specified that are not on any feature list you find any place, you should dial up. And then there are often undocumented features, which may be quite important to you. And you may find this on the web. Well, actually, I never did that, but you could do a search for undocumented and the software name, and you might find something. I believe that feature for 5.1 that I'm still using from time to time, of being able to define a looping macro from the keyboard without programming, I believe it's undocumented.
Interesting thing for iMovie that I use a lot in my mirror, they just kind of created a new iMovie for this 2008, and they completely changed the interface, and there's this thing that you used to do in the old one where you can extract the audio from a video file and move the audio wherever you want, but they renamed it in the new iMovie, so when you search the help for extract audio, you can't find it, but you can find it online.
But
searching for extract.
So the feature is still documented.
The feature is still there, but it's just undocumented.
Well,
it's redocumented.
It's not easily findable. It's not quite the same as undocumented. But the undocumented feature is something the programmer wrote in the program, but the documentation doesn't mention that you can do that.
It's almost like an off-label use of the word.
Yes. That's a good analogy. And you would find out from the web or by just happening out of it. Now, if you wanted to know, just to look ahead, how easy the feature is to use, you would either have to read the manual description, or you'd have to have the program to try it out. I mean, and just give you one example, this copying of cells in a table is, and I haven't figured out quite on the bottom which happens, but I think in all programs I know, sometimes what you copy replaces what's there, to your chagrin. And sometimes it inserts it. And if you really figure out how to do it, maybe you can do it, but the unsuspecting user, they have trouble. Actually, it just happened when I had my GA email me the spreadsheet for the grades for a course, and in one, it was one for the one sheet for the evening, one for the afternoon, one sheet, a whole bunch of columns was missing. And she had rearranged the columns that for my request, and something that happened. So obviously, the backup copy, and you could go back and repair it. But so, for that purpose, what I do is I always insert a blank column, or several blank columns. I copy several, and then I copy it. And sometimes the blank columns are still there, and something was filled. But that way, I know it. I don't copy to a known, in the known place. No. It may have something to do with whether you copy the column or the selection. If you copy the selection, I think it replaces what's in the column you move to. You copy the column, it inserts it. But just be safe. All right, so feature analysis is sort of conceptually the easiest, but it may be a lot of work because there are a lot of features possible. For program correctness, that is difficult. Because you need to run through all the features and with all the possibilities to make sure it's correct. I think for one, particularly for a piece of software that's being developed, you might need to do a protocol that prescribes the test for step by step what they have to do. That every feature is covered. If it's a program, so if it's a program that's mostly used interactively, you just have to think of all possible sequences of moves you could make. If it's a program that processes input, you need to think of all the possible things in input. I wrote a program for managing the thesaurus data, classification data. And we used it, and it sort of was tested, it was used. For real testing, I would have to have, one thing it does, it takes the hierarchically structured input file with dots, just like the ones you see here. Sometimes people do three dots and the next line has five dots. That's a mistake. So you need a file with that mistake to see what the program does. Otherwise, the first time it happens in practice, the program might crash or might do something. And I think I found out recently that when some text is too long without spaces, the program goes in an infinite loop. And that never happened It only happens now that people put URLs into scopings. And only URLs are long enough strings uninterrupted by space to cause the problem. And I didn't have test data before with such long strings. And I know it would be very easy to fix. I mean, I would just have to, I mean, the program constructs lines and it just checks. Then it gets too long, it goes back to a space and breaks a line there. But what if there is no space to break the line? Then it goes into infinite loop. So it could be fixed, but it was an error not detected because the test data didn't cover all possibilities. And many programs do process input data. And to test them, you have to have input data with all possible kinds of errors. You had a question?
This section 1.5 is on software testing and evaluation procedures. But
yeah.
Most of what we're going through now is
testing
and it's testing. So we're not going to be doing testing in this class, are we? Or are we? Evaluation.
Well, before you can evaluate, you have to test.
Okay.
Now, you might not be able to do the thorough testing that we're describing here.
Okay.
And you may have to rely on reviews to have done it.
Okay. So
but in real life, if you don't have those reviews, you better do some of your own testing.
Right. Because then you're testing all the features and things like that are...
It's too much work for this class.
For a developer, you can do that better than somebody with a final product because you can unit test to make sure that all the code gets walked. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you do it in every possible configuration.
And that all the code
gets impossible to do it this way becomes like it would take a lifetime.
So by what you mean by all the code gets walked, all the commands in the program written anywhere were executed at least. What?
The program code itself isn't broken, at least, internally.
Which is not self-evident, because if you don't do certain functions, or even certain errors or in the input data are not present.
But that's possible.
Some code might never be executed. And so if there's an error in that code, it may not be detected. But even if all the code works, it's worked once and worked. If it's running in a certain sequence, it may still not work.
It results all the input that you could possibly put in there.
Yes, yes. If
this
it
is an idealized review. It cannot necessarily be done.
It cannot necessarily be done completely. It may have to be done for important things. But compiling test data is very important for programs that process data. Okay. Walking through all possible paths of menu choice. Now, again, that's not something you can do for this class. May not be something you can do in reality. It's one reason they do beta tests, because they hope that if you have 100 people do it, most of the menu choice paths will be exercised at least once. Examine outputs carefully. Okay, and then you may also need to examine what's written to a database. I think we had a program to collect relevance judgments. And there was all kinds of ways to do it, and we wanted people to highlight pieces in abstract to say, my relevance judgment on this aspect is based on this sentence. So we had to make sure that all the highlights were properly recorded in the database so we could or the data were properly recorded, and there were more tricky things to it, but so you sort of have to, for a program like that that records data, you have to have an exact protocol of what's being input and what things are highlighted and what choices are made from a menu, and then you have to examine the database of the results that's produced from this interaction to make sure it actually is correct. If this is about inputting financial data and the program does accounting, you have to have a case where you input all the data and where you know what comes out so that you can know the program actually produces that result. Okay. And this is sort of like, so in that case, the program doesn't process a file, but it processes a series of inputs from a user. Say, a tax reporting software. We create a tax return. To test that, you have to have a number of tax returns that where the data are input to the program, and then somebody has to make sure that all the forms the program produced are actually correct and correspond to those inputs. And those tax return data that you input are your test data collection. The only difference is that in one case the test data are read in from a file. In this case the test data are in by a person. And you still have to make sure that the data are correct. So that is, this is examine outputs carefully. So the checking for program part that has not been executed, that can only be done for formative evaluation. It can only be done with inside a company. That's not something you can do. Testing in different hardware software environments, it's not something you can do for this class, but it's something you should do in real life. Just run it with different other software loaded, because it's quite common that there are conflicts between software. Try all the different plugins and see whether it actually works with them. Okay, and I said this is part of debugging. Okay, so now it's 3:30. Let's reconvene at 3:45. We will finish this and organize the software collection. Doesn't really need a whole lecture. I think I'll finish that today so we can jump into 2.2 on tomorrow. And possibly get out tomorrow as we surely don't send it. Bye. Okay, but right now I think everybody needs a break. Actually, I don't know, is the air conditioner still running or is it stopped?
Oh, we have a window.
The air conditioner. There's some.
You can feel it. It's very hot outside.
Yeah, so so tomorrow I think we'll have to see whether it's actually properly air conditioned. And if not, we'll have to take a walk.
I hope not. How would we all run?
I didn't. It's just typing too much. Too much time on the computer.
There's a sewing machine in this place.
Mm-hmm. When I drink, I'm gonna get one.
Yeah, how much is it?
And it's always $25.
Okay, then let me bring people around.
Sorry. That was not money. We're gonna need a closed coffee, but nothing open around here. Set up for everything. It takes time. I got a color if you need one.
Oh my god, one.
This is a beautiful one.
Of course, of course.
Purple line or start on it at least.
Yeah, I wish they did.
Second session. There's going to be like no break between.
Is there a week between?
Technically? Well, no, they're not on the calendar, I don't think.
When I push it forward,
what happens is what's here comes all the way back here so that the next set of words will pop up.
Uh-huh.
But what I still read left to right like you guys do.
Okay, so the words are marching left to right.
No, well, the words are marching right
to left. Left to right, but they're moving across. Like, if you're reading a scrolling screen.
But it would be like, you know, the software does. The would be on the left, software would be in the middle, and does would be on the right.
Yeah, that's sort of, I get that power for that explosive.
Okay, the thing, you start in the middle and go to the side, so I'm sure you're getting that block.
You don't even... because of which way, the ergonomics, the way I rest my hands, because if I did this all day, because one of the projects I'm working on, the words kind of march across real in big groups because they have fields they put them in, and then there's types and numbers in between. Mm-hmm. And I ignore those.
Was like a real primitive one of those. It wasn't anything like that.
No,
paper tapes sort of stuff.
Wow.
So that was really I tried to learn how to read it, and I got a little. I could make labels for his albums. That
oh,
was, you know, a little poke, you know, you use a little ball and you punch.
Yeah, I've actually got that here.
Yeah.
I still use it on occasion.
And this is just so much cooler.
Yeah, and it's more computer.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Absolutely.
Now, the reason that you're probably confused is because you have to write from right to left on that.
Yes.
Hit the letters at the same time.
And I've forgotten how. I was trying to remember what you were doing with what I remembered.
Mm-hmm. That's probably why it's confusing to you.
Yeah,
you're
done putting it out this way and you flip it over and read it. That's
right. That's why. It looks really weird people watching me write on that. And I'm like, what, you're going the wrong direction? I'm like, no. Yeah, and that's why it sounds confusing to you when I say that. Because moving, the letters are, in order for the new line to pop up, the letters are moving over.
Mm-hmm.
So that the next ones can pop up.
And then you just plug that into a PC? So
I can, because it's got a serial port. I also have two USB ports in which I plug in compact flash reader, because everything, actually my whole life is on my flash card. I learned that the hard way. I was taking a course in library history, and I just about finished my paper, and it is a weak key.
Ooh.
I did not have a backup. I said to my friend, I want to go get drunk. This is I can't believe I did this. I cried, and then after I cried, I started all over.
Oh,
that was awful. The professor kept us away because he talked so loud and we were headed studying.
No, I didn't. Okay.